Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Twin suicide bombings in Russia could threaten the most expensive Olympics ever. Why Twitter's stock price keeps going up and down, and the business of selling a body part. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl. And this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, December 30th. Thanks for being with us. And we're going to start the show with Russia, where a second suicide bombing in as many days shook the city of Volgograd, killing at least 15 people. Volgograd is about 400 miles northeast of Sochi, where the Winter Olympics are set to start in 6 weeks. The Games will likely cost about $50 billion, making them the most expensive ever. We called up the BBC's Artem Lis in Moscow to talk about the risk to the Games. Artem, thank you so much for joining me.
No problem.
What are people saying about these bombings, and how have they kind of settled into the perception of whether Russia is ready for Sochi?
I think a lot of people in Russia are in shock. A lot of people certainly did not expect something like this to happen, especially this close to the Sochi Olympics. You have to understand that over the last few years, the media here, the state-controlled media, have been saying day in, day out that the insurgency in Russia is under control, that the Sochi Games will be, and I'm quoting, the safest Olympics in history. Most people are just concentrating on the day-to-day, as it were. But there is a very palpable sense of unease, certainly here in Moscow, and in other places around Russia as well.
A lot of money has been spent on the Games and on security. Is there a sense that you have that more will be spent and security preparations will be ramped up elsewhere?
Well, look, President Putin has already said that security will be strengthened across the country. But then ultimately it's a question about whether the money is being spent in the right way. A lot of work being done by the security officials here is centered around trying to weaken President Putin's perceived or real political opponents. And a lot of the security experts here are saying that this amount of money and this amount of resource and effort could have been better spent trying to infiltrate those extremist cells and trying to tackle them.
What does it mean for Sochi and for Russia if tourists don't come?
Well, I think it'll be a massive blow. But I think it's too soon to say how it will affect the tourists, people coming to the Olympics. And a lot of the Russians do believe the Kremlin when the Kremlin says that the Olympic Games as such will be very secure. As far as the foreigners go, well, yes, I imagine some people will now be thinking, should they actually be going to Russia? Is it dangerous or is it not? I don't think there's anything that the Kremlin can say that will persuade them one way or the other. And I think it will remain ultimately their choice.
How much does Russia need these to go well?
Well, the Olympics has been President Putin's sort of pet project for the last few years, really. If you think about the recent events in Russia before those bombings, the amnesty which affected Pussy Riot and Greenpeace, and the pardon of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, these are all the steps President Putin has been taking to ensure that there is good PR ahead of the Olympics. Mm-hmm. It's a project of massive importance for Russia, of course, and for the Olympic movement, but also for President Putin's personal vanity, a lot of people will have you believe.
Artem Lis from the BBC in Moscow, thank you so much for talking with me.
Pleasure.
On Wall Street today, mostly flat, not a lot of action going on. We'll have details when we do the numbers. are listening to this program and have a Swiss bank account, now could be a decent time to admit it, especially if you haven't been paying your U.S. taxes. Tomorrow is the deadline for famously secretive Swiss banks to sign up for non-prosecution deals with the U.S. government in exchange for passing over detailed account information about their American clients. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Con men, cheating spouses, and tax evaders, take note. Your Swiss bank is likely going to rat you out. Jeffrey Nyman is an attorney in Fort Lauderdale. He helped prosecute the case against the Swiss bank UBS.
The Justice Department and the IRS have always looked at these cases as if you come clean, if you come forward before we get your name, you can avoid prosecution.
But owning up isn't as easy as writing a heartfelt apology to the IRS. Dear IRS, my bad. Love, Adrian.
Americans with undeclared assets need to file 8 years of amended tax returns, 8 years of delinquent other forms, and they're going to have to pay whatever tax is owed.
8 years of tax forms. Big penalties. It sounds like a lot. But not reporting, says Nyman, it could be a whole lot worse.
You're risking jail.
And losing a big chunk of that account value. So let's weigh the odds. Just how likely is it really that the government will track you down? I asked James Hines, a law professor at the University of Michigan.
You know, the thinking now is it's probably going to come out. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but before too long.
Swiss banks don't want trouble with the U.S. government any more than the rest of us. They're likely to hand over your account information if it keeps them off a prosecutor's to-do list, which is why lawyers think the best thing hidden account holders can do is fess up. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Twitter's stock has had quite a ride in the past week. It swung from $60 a share up to almost $75 and then right back down again. Current price about 61, and this is what we call some serious volatility. So why do some stocks careen around like this? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
Volatility is as volatility does. Is that an expression?
What you're seeing is just the uncertainty and the volatility of the underlying economics feeding through into the price.
Scott Clemens is chief investment strategist at Brown Brothers Harriman. He says the price of any stock is based on two things. How much money do people think the company will make in the future? And how much is that worth? For a company like Twitter, which hasn't made money yet, estimates vary wildly.
Some analysts believe that Twitter is the best thing since sliced bread. Other analysts can look at it and say, you know, remember MySpace. The valuation is more a matter of faith than it is a matter of analytical observation.
So naturally, the price is going to be pretty volatile, too. Eric Parnell is founder of Gearing Wealth Management. He says this time of year is usually especially volatile.
So many people are on vacation, so there's relatively few market participants.
It's like if there's a smaller crowd, people and their trades stand out more. Plus, hello, taxes.
It's a good opportunity to lock in gains, position yourself from a tax perspective.
Now, volatility might be scary if you're invested in a stock and you're watching it bounce all over the place, but in general, it's really not a bad thing. Scott Wren is a senior equity strategist with Wells Fargo Advisors.
Volatility is an opportunity. You want volatility. You want the market to have some pullback to it because it gives you opportunities to invest some cash.
But it turns out, Twitter notwithstanding, volatility right now is at a low for the year, which means investors are either timid or complacent, which means in the next year, something's probably going to give. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
An update on a competition we've covered on this show. The FAA has officially picked 6 states to host test sites for drones. Texas, North Dakota, New York, Nevada, Virginia, and Alaska all won. After a 10-month application process, 24 states submitted proposals. The biggest growth for the commercial drone industry is in agriculture and law enforcement, though there still aren't really rules for how these things are supposed to fly around with regular planes. Those won't come until at least 2015. All right, slackers. You have less than a day to finalize your New Year's Eve plans. And for many people, there's not that much to plan. Stay inside, avoid crowds, and watch the ball drop from the comfort of your couch. But if you want to see it up close, Applebee's in Times Square has a deal for you. $375 gets you into the restaurant, an open bar, and a buffet. Marketplace's David Weinberg called around to some businesses around the country that are hoping to lure you out of the house this New Year's.
Maybe spending New Year's at an Applebee's surrounded by lots of drunk people isn't your idea of a good time. Perhaps you want something a little classier, like the $85 four-course dinner at 80 Thoreau in Concord, Massachusetts, starting with the foie gras torchon and duck prosciutto, a departure from the normal menu.
So this is actually set up more so like a, almost like a tasting menu style.
Vincent Vella is the maitre d' and co-owner of 80 Thoreau, one of many restaurants around the country offering New Year's Eve tasting menus. This is a big New Year's for restaurants, says David Adler, the CEO of BizBash Media.
There is a lot of people still going out for New Year's Eve, especially because this has been such a long holiday week, couple weeks.
Adler says the proliferation of foodie culture has made New Year's a night for chefs to showcase their talents. And because it's a special night, people will spend a little more than they normally would. For those who aren't in the 1% but want to party like they are, you could take a cruise on the Lady Windridge in Fort Lauderdale.
If you want to have a wonderful party on board a boat, then come to Windridge and you will get just exactly what your dreams are all about.
Kathleen Windridge is the owner of the yacht, which she normally rents for private parties and corporate events. The New Year's Eve tickets are $175 for a four-hour cruise with open bar and a buffet.
We finished being sold out today, so we're very, very fortunate.
New Year's is also a night for nonprofits to raise money through charity events. In Los Angeles, Ron Lynch, a comedian and voice on the TV show Bob's Burgers, is hosting a live show at the Steve Allen Theater, a portion of the proceeds going to the nonprofit Trepany House.
It's only $20. We tried to make it as cheap as possible and still kind of try to make a little bit of money.
The show will feature comedians from Mr. Show and Community, and live music from members of CeeLo Green's band will close the show with a dance party. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up.
A lot of my friends called me Rapunzel from the time I was a teenager. I've always had long hair.
Selling body parts to help make a living. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took a break, a breather, a pause as the year wound down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 25 points, 0.1%, to close at 16,504. The NASDAQ gave up 2 points, less than 0.1%, ending at 4,154. The S&P 500 ticked down less than a point, basically flat, to close at 1,841. On the marquee today, Walt Disney bumping up 2.5% to a record high after an analyst upgraded the Mouse House. Twitter dropped another 5% after Friday's 13% slide, after an analyst said the stock had risen too far, too fast. Facebook faded 3%. European markets were down. The German DAX scratched off 0.4%. London's FTSE fell 0.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace. So please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. 2013 is rapidly coming to a close. Feeling sentimental? You have one more day to wallow. For those who follow lesser-known annual observances, enjoy No Interruptions Day to quietly reflect and prepare for the new year. And it's the last trading day. Review your portfolio, take a peek at your champagne inventory, and might as well check on your supplies of grapes, black-eyed peas, and long noodles, foods thought to bring good luck. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. The U.S. prison system spends about $6.5 billion a year treating things like mental illness, substance abuse, and chronic disease. But when a prisoner is released, a lot of that care stops. Ex-cons often go right back to their problems, and many land back in jail. And taxpayers pick up the health care check all over again. Starting in January, changes to Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act could interrupt this cycle as hundreds of thousands of former prisoners become eligible for insurance. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Dan Gorenstein reports.
Miguel Rodriguez has been in and out of prison for more than 30 years, usually for selling heroin. And after every release, it's been the same story.
Go to the corner, the gold cell, and get high.
And then land back in prison all over again. When he was released for the last time a couple of years ago, Rodriguez, now 53, was suffering from hepatitis C, congestive heart failure, and asthma.
I couldn't walk from here to that window. It would take me about a good half hour to walk one block. That's how bad my health was.
He's been to the hospital 6 times, the emergency room 10. He's had a pacemaker and bypass surgery. But because he can't pay, hospitals have eaten those costs, which get passed on to the rest of us. University of Colorado's Dr. Ingrid Binswanger says the Affordable Care Act might catch people like Rodriguez before their health hits rock bottom and their health care costs skyrocket.
We could potentially treat those conditions and deal with them before they get to the point where people need to be hospitalized or go to the emergency room.
Under the new health law, nearly half of all inmates who leave prison next year, some 300,000, will be eligible for health insurance primarily through Medicaid. Historically, many states have barred low-income adults without children from signing up. Under the ACA, that restriction now goes away.
There has been nothing in my career that has been this exciting as this moment.
Dr. Emily Wong teaches at Yale Medical School and treats former inmates. Wong has seen that simple access to care, particularly for substance abuse or mental health, can help ex-cons find their footing and save money, big money, in part because they're so expensive to treat.
Individuals that are released from prison, they are 12 times more likely to die even in the first 2 weeks following release. They're more likely to be hospitalized. They're more likely to go to the emergency department.
Jack Beck is with the Correctional Association of New York, which monitors prison conditions.
What the public generally doesn't know is that we are essentially cycling people with mental illness, substance abuse problems through our jails and prisons and back out again.
Behind bars, Beck explains, inmates get treatment. They get meds, their chronic conditions in check. When they get out, all that goes away. And Dr. Wong says that's when taxpayers get slammed.
Because you're paying for the cost of their care now. You're paying for the cost of their care in the community when they return home, when they're using the emergency department, when they're hospitalized for conditions that are preventable.
Wong says the next step is to get insurance to former inmates as soon as they hit the streets. That may not be as easy, though, as it sounds. Donna Strugar-Fritch works with prison officials as a consultant with Health Management Associates.
Nobody is really responsible, no agency, for what happens to ex-offenders when they leave.
She says many states are still putting systems in place to simply make sure inmates walk out of prison with Medicaid cards. And even for those who are insured, there's a shortage of treatment programs for substance abuse and mental illness. But in states expanding Medicaid, there's momentum to deal with these knotty questions. Bottom line, it costs a lot more to keep someone in prison than it does to provide them with the kind of health care services that might keep them out. Miguel Rodriguez, who says he's stopped taking heroin, goes to an outpatient substance abuse program several times a week. And soon, he'll have Medicaid.
Because now I can make my doctor's appointments. I can get my medication.
But insurance is a tool. It's no guarantee. For this to work, Rodriguez must do something he's never been able to do, take care of his health. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Many news organizations round out the year with best of and end of the year lists. We asked our correspondents instead to think about the future and look ahead to the stories they think will dominate their beats in 2014. We're going to kick off this series of conversations with our China Bureau Chief, Rob Schmitz, who joins me from Shanghai. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Lizzie.
So looking ahead into 2014, we asked you to think about it. And you sort of chose the theme forced transparency. What does that mean exactly?
Well, a forced transparency is when, for example, in this case, the government of China is forced to show what is going on behind the curtains of power. And at the beginning of this year, we had what was called the airpocalypse in Beijing, when smog was so bad that the airport was shut down. People weren't even able to drive. This is all a hangover effect from 3 decades of double-digit economic growth. Now people are starting to see stories about how deaths from lung cancer are up more than 400%. Children are now being diagnosed with lung cancer for the first time. And on New Year's Day in 2013, nearly 100 cities throughout China began reporting air quality data for the first time. So people now check hourly air quality readings on their smartphones, and they're finally understanding how bad the air really is.
And when you think about next year, what does the party have to do in order to convince people that it can grow the country and not endanger their health?
Well, I think it's a big problem. You know, if China's government really wants to, I think it can begin to turn this problem around. And we may see more big policy measures in 2014 aimed to clean this up, because the environment has not only become a stability threat, but it's also become an economic threat to China and the rest of the world.
When we're talking about China's economy, one thing that has also changed significantly this year is the flows of capital among and between banks. Talk to me a little bit about that. It can sound academic, but it's really important when you look at how quickly the Chinese economy is growing.
Absolutely. And this is sort of my second pick of the biggest story of 2013 in China. In June, China's central bank took emergency measures and froze all lending between banks. And this was a very bad sign. China has been inside of an enormous credit bubble for years. And the People's Bank of China tried to pop that bubble a little to let some air out. You know, this basically boils down to China's economic growth model, which is borrow, 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 build, build, build. You know, 70% of China's GDP growth is generated by building infrastructure, and that's meant a lot of loans and a lot of bad debt. For years, China's government has done its best to hide the more unpleasant economic fallout from all this. But the interbank lending crisis was a moment where everyone saw what was really going on behind the curtains of China's economy. And it wasn't pretty. It's a lot like the air pollution problem. They're both examples of how China's government is being forced to be more transparent about the collateral damage from an unbalanced economy.
Is it too strong to call these kind of emperor has no clothes moments?
No, absolutely not. And I think we'll see more events like this in 2014, where the government can no longer hide what's really happening from its own people, because the fallout from 30 years of economic growth at all costs is becoming more and more obvious to everyone here.
Wow. Our China Bureau Chief, Rob Schmitz from Shanghai, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Lizzie.
Here's a way to learn about a little slice of our economy. Go to Google and type in the phrase, I want to sell my, and see what comes up. Yeah, the top suggestion is car, but the others, hair, kidney, eggs. Audrey Quinn has this story about what we sell and when and why.
Mary Brown's a mother of four in Provo, Utah, and this fall she said goodbye to something very close to her.
I rolled it kind of like a rope and placed it in the bag and placed that into a mailing envelope, and off it went.
Brown had a nickname growing up.
A lot of my friends called me Rapunzel. From the time I was a teenager, I've always had long hair.
In October, that long hair became that rope she placed in a bag. Brown had spent the last 4 years getting her hair ready to sell.
I did a lot of research. You don't want to use heating products on your hair. You want to use very mild shampoos. It also helps if you are eating really healthfully and taking multivitamins.
Her sister had put her in touch with a hair sales website, and Brown put together an ad for her hair.
My husband and I went, and we took 2 or 3 days to do photo shoots around my hair and picked the best ones we could with my hair down, with my hair braided, so you could see the different shades of blonde.
I checked out the ad myself. Brown's hair was crazy long, super shiny, and incredibly straight. A woman who makes hair extensions in Australia saw the ad, too. She bought Brown's hair for $1,000. Brown's ad was on hairwork.com. Marlis Fladlin runs the website.
I am the first to start a business like this in the United States.
It's now one of at least 4 sites where you can sell your hair online. Fladlin's seen hair sell from anywhere between $100 and $4,000. She charges people $25 for an ad. She hosts about 20 to 30 a month.
What kind of people want to sell their hair online?
Well, everybody that needs money sells hair. I think it's actually more when the economy is bad, because hair is something that you can grow back. And when people need money, they'll find a way.
She says she sees more people trying to sell their hair around the holidays, when wallets are especially empty. To better understand these hair sales, I went to see Nicholas Colas. He's a market analyst at the brokerage firm Convergix. He's been examining interest in sales like these: hair, milk, eggs, even kidneys. That's kind of horrifying.
It is horrifying, and obviously selling a kidney is actually illegal in the U.S., or purchasing one as well. But it is, to my mind, speaks to the kind of relative desperation that a lot of people still have about their economic condition.
Colas says the stock market may be doing well, but the economic recovery hasn't filtered to middle-class people. He doesn't think that many people are actually selling their kidneys. But he sees hair and breast milk sales as a creative response to hard times.
I find it very admirable. It requires a lot of ingenuity, and it requires a lot of focus to do what it takes to make things happen for you.
Mary Brown, the one who sold her hair for $1,000, she says her experience has made her look at hair differently.
I think that when I look at people now with long, beautiful hair, in my head, I calculate how much they could probably sell that for if they wanted to. You know, she could probably get a good $300 for that ponytail, or, ooh, that hair is really thick. She might be able to get $1,000, $1,300 even.
Brown says she's doing all right money-wise, but she has a number of friends who aren't, and she wanted to help them out. So far, the cash has gone to one friend's school loan and to another friend's car repair. In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note. It is a fact, universally acknowledged, that if you combine Jane Austen and economics, I can't resist it. We don't know exactly what was going on at Citibank over the holidays, but we're delighted that their strategist Stephen Englander decided to explain monetary and fiscal policy using Jane Austen quotes. Here's an argument for Fed transparency. I don't approve of surprises. The pleasure is never enhanced, and the inconvenience is considerable. To justify quantitative easing, how about this one? A large income is the best recipe for happiness. And for entitlement reform, there's this snarky one. People always live forever when there is an annuity to be paid them. Those are from Emma and Pride and Prejudice. Our thanks to Business Insider, who saw the Citibank note. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 25 points. That's 0.1%. The NASDAQ gave up 2 points, less than 0.1%. And the S&P 500 ticked down less than a point, closing basically flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodnar and Tommy Andres, and Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll meet you back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.